Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. So we have additional participants watching online, which is great. So this presentation session, so this is not a panel. It's the idea is that we've presented on a new piece of research we've been working on. But it's a presentation for a piece of work that will be published later this month at a launch event in Abuja, Nigeria. But we are keen to use the opportunity to sort of give you a sneak peek of the findings and perhaps discuss a little bit what they mean. So this is being hosted by the Humanitarian Policy Group, which is the one of the largest teams in ODI. So ODI is a global affairs think tank, a nonprofit that is based in London, with does a broad swathe of work on global development and humanitarian issues. So my name's John Bryant. I'm a researcher with HPG. And joining me is Ahmad, if you'd like to
Yes,
introduce yourself.
my name is Ahmad Jumari. I'm a director of programs at NEEM Foundation. So it's nice to be here with you all. NEEM Foundation is a non-profit organization that does work in parts of Africa, particularly areas of the Sahel and the Lake Chad Basin countries. These are countries that have been significantly affected by the ISWAP insurgency. That's the Islamic State of the West Africa Peninsula, as well as Boko Haram. I'm sure a lot of you must have heard of Boko Haram by now. So we will be glad to talk a bit about some of our work in those regions, as well as more particularly in Nigeria. Thank you.
Thanks. So the idea behind this session is that I'll present on the summary of research that our team and NEEM Foundation have done collaboratively over the past year or so. And then I'll hand over to Ahmad to take us through a little bit of NEEM Foundation's work. And that's really important to hear because among the approaches that NEEM is doing is one that we sort of agree has a perhaps a more developmental lens, is particularly suited, of course, to Nigeria, the North Nigeria context, and of course, NEEM Foundation being a local and national actor has a unique kind of perspective on some of the issues that I'll be talking about. So I'll have a hand in sort of diagnosing the set of issues that are present in Northern Nigeria's humanitarian response, and then I'll defer to Ahmad, who can present some reflections and potential ways forward. So in brief, essentially the study that we've been doing explores the state of humanitarian provision in Nigeria and why certain crises within the country appear to attract more humanitarian resources and attention than others. Specifically, it focuses on the discrepancy in humanitarian assistance and service provision between three states in the northeast of the country and three states in the northwest. And we found that although both regions now face comparably high levels of humanitarian need, they receive very different levels of support. So we sought to find out why and what this discrepancy means for principled humanitarian responses. So the explanation as to why these responses differ is a combination of how, primarily of how the two crises have been framed and understood, how the humanitarian sector operates and learns, and how state and federal governments have responded. So those factors explain, but they don't justify, we argue, a quite strikingly different humanitarian presence in the face of comparable needs that threaten to rapidly deteriorate in the Northwest region, where there is still only quite a minimal humanitarian presence. So we've conducted the research and we highlight the implications of these findings, but we obviously don't have the full range of answers, and that's why we'd be keen to hear from you either online or in the room as well. A brief mention of the study itself. So the paper is a product of a collaborative piece of research between NEEM Foundation and ODI. So the methodology for this study was co-designed by researchers in the two organizations. So primary data collection comprised focus group discussions with affected people and aid staff, as well as key informant interviews across the Northeast and the Northwest. So this took place in sort of September, October 2023. A total of 36 focus groups were conducted. At least 8 discussants per focus group, and including aid users and humanitarian practitioners, some separated by gender, others not. And that was supplemented by 48 key informant interviews with humanitarian staff, government representatives, and journalists, as well as desk reviews of available literature. So just a brief overview for those of you who are not perhaps familiar with the context and where exactly we're talking about. So there are 6 states you'll see on the map behind me in the Northeast, so of which 3, so Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe, so together form the acronym BAE, so the BAE states. They're the focus of the international humanitarian response. And then on the left side of the map are the 7 states of the Northwest, of which Sokoto, Zamfara, and Katsina were the focus of our primary research, and also the areas of highest humanitarian need. So some key kind of takeaway messages, if I'm very conscious of people being open and receptive to information for around, I think it was something like 8 or 11, between 8 and 11 minutes, and then people switch off. So this slide is the takeaway messages, really. So Northwest Nigeria has comparable needs to the Northeast, but lacks a major humanitarian response, point one. Point two, the stark difference is because the conflict framing in the Northeast has driven attention and responses, while the framing of the Northwest has effectively worked to depoliticize and deprioritize the crisis faced there. And there's deepening regional disparities in the humanitarian and state response are a consequence of that framing, and they've helped entrench it. So a humanitarian response based on need in northern Nigeria is now very urgent, and prioritization at a subnational level, we argue, should be more insulated from the global geopolitics that we are all well aware dictate unequal allocations of aid funding. Responses should be understood agnostically in the Nigeria context, we argue. But we sort of finish by saying, look, a response to the Northwest cannot and should not be a repeat of the Northeast, and lessons can be learned from local responders working in the region. And I think I'll defer to Ahmed on that final point as well. So, in brief as I can be, there's comparable crises and divergent responses present in the two regions. So in the Northeast, it's believed that around 4 million people are in danger of malnutrition. In the Bay States, violence continues to have a very high humanitarian impact, despite the region often being referred to as being post-conflict. And food security remains a key challenge. And over 80% of vulnerable people who need humanitarian assistance in those Bay States are women and children. Protection concerns regularly highlight the extent of gender-based violence, as well as gaps in service provision. And just to mention a previous piece of work that HPG, my team, has done, we've argued that in previous work with NEEM Foundation, that figure of 80% likely hides another dimension of the crisis in the region, because access to the region's so-called garrison towns has been described as higher for women and children. And that likely distorts reporting and is likely to have hidden high needs among men who are just underrepresented in internally displaced camps and humanitarian data. So that's a product of a previous piece of work that we did on inclusion and humanitarian responses, which I encourage you to check out, and I can provide the link to. So that's the Northeast. The Northwest also faces significant humanitarian needs. So the region is Nigeria's poorest. Sokoto is the poorest state in the country. 91% of residents experience multidimensional poverty, according to OCHA. There's growing competition over land, food, water, That usually sits along ethnic lines in the region's sort of infamous kind of farmer herder conflict that you may have come across. That drives repeated silent cycles of violence and retribution. And then fleeing from that violence, much of which is carried out by armed groups referred to as bandits, that cyclical model of displacement has become a real survival strategy for many. And that needs in the Northwest are now so high that the levels of need have sort of converged between the Northwest and the Northeast. In fact, the Northwest, according to latest figures from the IPC, actually has 22% of surveyed local government areas in the Northeast record acute malnutrition phase three or higher. It's actually 64%. It's three times higher in the Northwest region as of last year. A further 16% on top of that in the Northwest have a phase four critical classification. They're the only areas of the country, I think, that have that classification. So it's a very urgent, pressing humanitarian situation in the Northwest. And by that metric, at least, which is just one metric, because we know needs are higher in the region, not covered by the international humanitarian response structure. We can also point to other statistics, which I won't cover now, but comparable levels of violence, comparable levels of people internally displaced. Those numbers are very difficult to get accurate pictures of, but what is clear is it's an enormous number of people in the Northwest that are not covered by the humanitarian system. So that's one side of the equation in terms of humanitarian needs. There, the similarities really stop quite markedly. So the international humanitarian response is focused on the Bay States. That's the area where OCHA presides over a humanitarian cluster system. Its HRPs have focused on those three states, although in recent years there has been at least an acknowledgement in the HRPs that there are needs in the Northwest. And the Northeast saw back in 2016 a relative outpouring of funding by various donors and multilateral agencies. That spurred on us and provided a degree of political pressure for Nigeria's the federal government to act, and affected subnational state governments and donors have also benefited from the original 2016 Northeast Recovery and Peacebuilding Assessment exercise, which was really the kind of starting point for the scale of the response in the Northeast. And since then, funding has, as we know, with all protracted longer-term humanitarian crises, has struggled to maintain that momentum. But even in the last couple of years, relatively speaking, it is sort of, comparatively funded. It's in the norm of percentage funded. So there's an average of 66% of financial requirements were met under the plan since 2016. The HRP last year was 68% funded. So there are significant challenges in the humanitarian response in the Northeast. That's a really far cry from the current situation in the Northwest. International donors in the UN system are not present in any comparable way, and the federal government has also yet to formally put its weight behind a comprehensive recovery and peacebuilding assessment exercise. And that's meant not only a lack of response, but also very little by way of a region-wide understanding of what the actual needs are. And limited media reporting, that sort of exacerbated a real lack of awareness of what's proved to be quite a deteriorating situation. And as a little sort of proxy measure, we can compare the numbers of INGOs present. So there are, according to one figure, there are 46 INGOs present in the Northeast. In the words of one humanitarian interviewee that I interviewed, that's too many. In contrast to the Northwest, has single figures. So four have been recognized by an analysis by MSF, But the lack of OCHA has meant any coordination of the response has had to happen quite informally through the INGO forum and the role of UNICEF, which has been very positive in drawing attention to the Northwest. Those differences are not limited to coordination. The three-state OCHA mandate in the Northeast has an impact on response financing, available data, and the impact of the discrepancy can also be seen in the difference that we the differences we saw between humanitarian aid received in the two regions. So among the study's focus group participants in the Northeast Bay states, everybody had at least received some form of humanitarian assistance. Appreciate is a low base, that is a low baseline, but and it was generally a mix of in-kind assistance, food and cash. So there was mention of skills training, cash provided with the aim of starting businesses, and a sort of commonly raised form of help in the groups in the Northeast, especially Yobe and Adamawa, actually. And peace building and reconciliation interventions are also a feature of the humanitarian and government services in the region. Those indicative findings are consistent with more comprehensive needs assessment surveys. So, an earlier study carried out by Ground Truths shows the majority of people surveyed in the Northeast expressed qualified support that assistance, especially cash and vouchers, did meet important basic needs in areas covered by the international response. And 73% of recipients in a study by Humanitarian Outcomes several years ago surveyed that they were satisfied with the aid that they were receiving, in contrast to areas outside of coverage. So the difference in services is very clear when you compare that with the Northwest. So we conducted focus groups there, or rather, Neem Foundation conducted focus groups there. One group of 12 focus group participants in Katsina had not received any aid at all. And what assistance was received across the region was also more basic as well. So there's a quantity and also a sort of quality issue. It's primarily food relief, and longer term interventions were reported as being rare. So pressing needs were reported variously as food, cash, livelihood, security. And those findings similarly are consistent with other studies, which, despite the substantial humanitarian funds deployed to affected communities, findings suggest that 89% of households have never received any humanitarian assistance in Zamfara and Katsina, according to us. That's a study by Reach from last year. I've already talked for a while, so I'll go very briefly over this. In essence, we sort of argue in the report that the nature of the conflicts and the responses to them have been the sort of central determinant in how their respective humanitarian responses have unfolded. So in short, there's explicit linkages in the Northeast between the insurgency and wider sort of transnational jihadist groups. That's helped frame a sort of compelling narrative for both kind of domestic and international audiences, including donors. That has had sort of patchy international media, diplomatic, humanitarian attention. In contrast, the violence in the Northwest and its symptoms, they're of similar proportions, and the symptoms are similar, but there is a lack of a clearly identifiable group, and that's contributed to a wider sort of depoliticization of the conflict, and that's diminished its sort of international significance, and with it sort of attention and funding. I'll skip over the conflict dynamics, because maybe Ahmad can speak to that. But there are also factors, we argue, that the humanitarian sector does have greater control over, and many concerns about potential greater engagement in the Northwest among humanitarian interviewees we spoke with stem from the lessons learned from the response in the Northeast, which was generally in anonymous interviews described as being quite tightly controlled, very expensive, and ultimately unsustainable. And for interviewed sector staff, growing needs and access made their roles very difficult. And state-level authorities were seen as a key determining factor in whether they succeeded. And there's interesting sort of disparities within the Bay States between a response in Borno that is seen as very restrictive versus potentially brighter spots in areas like Adamawa, which have received less funding, but have potentially made gains in regard to post-conflict sort of dynamics and other projects. And then sort of humanitarian interviewees generally put a perceived lack of leverage in negotiations with state authorities as one of the key reasons for many of the challenges in the Northeast. And we're very wary of sort of transposing those dynamics into a whole other area of Nigeria. Again, we perhaps we can talk about this more in the discussion, but also, you know, there's a role of government as well in our findings, and the disconnect between state and federal authorities was also cited as contributing to a disparity in provision. Nigeria being highly federalized, the powers of local government essentially also ex or state government extend to, in effect, raising the alarm to central government and international humanitarian actors in instances of critical need, but the ability of affected t states to do so does seem to be highly variable, particularly in the Northwest, with authorities that are maybe less familiar with the humanitarian system and how it operates. There's also quite fractious state and federal relations are sort of were cited as key causes of regional disparities. So, in sum, and I've very quickly gone over that, it's the reasons for the disparity in services in the two regions. They're a product of both the conflict itself and the responses to it. So, the government actors, international actors, and state actors all have a kind of role to play in the current situation, and they also have a role to sort of alleviating that disparity. So, those findings are obviously important in their own right, but I just wanted to briefly touch on, you know, the context also raises questions that has relevance for other contexts, and this is something we talk about at greater length in the paper. Just to sort of go over these very, very briefly, the humanitarian sector has, Hugo Slim describes, a bit of a policy vacuum around the specific definition and prioritization of need. And while there are increasingly sophisticated analysis tools at a sort of operational level that can inform responses, larger scale decisions, of which the one that I've just talked about, around which needs are attempted to be met, are often left to individual organizations themselves and their own mandates. But prioritization is really becoming a debate out of necessity and a consequence of comparatively decreasing funding for current approaches, for current levels of global need. And much of the recent focus that I know my own team has done in its research has been around inclusion of specific marginalized groups of people. That's very important. What's very striking about this context is that, coming into it as a non-Nigeria specialist, is that it's the issue of entire geographies being rendered effectively invisible to international responses. That's less commonly discussed in inclusion debates, but it's obviously a very important one in this context. There's also a lot of sort of implications for localization, which I will definitely defer to Ahmad on, and we can talk about that. But essentially, for some interviewees in local and national NGOs, the situation of a sort of concentrated humanitarian presence serving high density camps, mainly in Borno, that's indicative not of not so much a lack of effective prioritization, but it's more a sector-wide issue of a lack of meaningful participation and localization. And maybe we can touch on that in Ahmed's remarks as well. And then there's lastly the nexus, and that the nexus approach between the humanitarian world, the development world, and the peace building world. That's that approach that we are all a proponent of, I think, is proved difficult to put into practice in the Nigeria context. And the logic that humanitarian action is inappropriate for long-term needs, it can, in protracted settings, damage local responses, substitute for government obligations and responsibilities. That's very well known, and it's particularly apparent in a context like the Nigeria case. The balance between those groups of actors in the Northeast does seem to be especially skewed towards the humanitarian, and there were criticisms as to the lack of development actors, including the Nigerian state, present in the Northeast to hand over programs to. That's common in other crises as well, obviously. Fears of humanitarian actors becoming sort of providers of first resort and la first and last resort do appear to be well-founded, considering the length of the intervention, which is now sort of approaching a decade at that scale. I think we can maybe touch on that in more detail, but in terms of next steps and recommendations, it's important to note that this is clearly a very difficult context in which to operate in, and there's access constraints, there's insecurity, there's very complicated political dynamics happening. We're concentrating here really on the sort of outdated kind of response structure rather than, individual entities and individual organizations, which we know are sort of doing pretty amazing work in quite difficult circumstances. And that's a product of, the situation is the product of a degree of inertia and incentives that do need challenging in these kind of forums, really. So there is a now a bit of a budding coalition of humanitarian actors that are pivoting to the northwest, and a sort of loosely organized response taking shape. So the INGO Forum, MSF, UNICEF, I've already mentioned, are prominent. There are now urgent calls for sort of greater attention on Northern Nigeria as a whole, from Plan and World Vision at the start of this year. Needs are great and growing. Some interviewees also observed a greater willingness now for involvement in the Northwest to sort of challenge these critical needs and address these critical needs. But we also argue that the challenges of the Northeast response mean that while lessons should be learned, it should not be considered necessarily a model to emulate in its entirety in any kind of future Northwest response. And there's an opportunity to attempt a different approach that's more flexible. It's informed by humanitarian and development sectors, and draws on the strength of under-supported local actors and organizations. And the patterns of insecurity and climate and displacement faced by people in the Northwest, they're also far from unique globally and likely necessitate developing new models of responses that are resilient and longer term and grounded in needs in a more sort of agnostic sense, as I mentioned. So that is very briefly my sort of summary of the work that we both of our organizations have done together. I just want to hand over to Ahmed now to maybe sort of reflect on the findings. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, John. And again, thank you everyone for your patience. I know a lot of times presenting a paper is different from presenting a tool. Like myself and John attended a program here yesterday. Again, just to touch on a few areas that were mentioned, I think. Particularly the element of localization you mentioned, John, is one that is very interesting to us. In fact, that's the story of how NEEM Foundation started, and I'll get to that shortly. Particularly, one of the things that we found very interesting, and I think in the early days when we started NEEM Foundation, we went to Borno. And we're looking for numbers. We're looking for statistics in terms of numbers of IDPs, numbers of persons in host communities. And you know, the funny part of it is when we got to the specific commission responsible for collecting that data, the first reference they made was according to UN. This is the information we had. And you know, in the past, usually when you go to these agencies, they would quote the National Bureau of Public Statistics, you know. So what we found was that there was a shift from having that in-house capacity, either of states or national actors, to provide that service to a more internationalized system. I think that's something that we found. Particularly, I think it was the case to some extent in Niger as well, just across the border. You also touch based on the context of the Northeast and Northwest is one that again it's both intertwined by perceptions as well as also framing, like you mentioned, John. So for instance, what you find in the Northeast is a lot of individuals or groups would frame it from the perspective of ideology, right? They would say that the context of the Northeast is driven by an ideological crisis, which is came in the face of Boko Haram and ISWAP and other groups. But in the Northwest, what you find is that they use this term, they could refer to it as bandit groups. It's a very loose term that refers to anyone willing to pick up arms and go into communities to cause chaos. Another point that I would like to also add is the role that messaging plays in actually driving these sort of responses or even decision-making processes. Is anyone familiar with the, if you're familiar with the Chibok Girl incident, please raise up your hand. The Chibok Girls. Are you familiar with the term, the Chibok Girls? Okay, so I think a substantial amount of you at least know what that means. Have you heard of the Jengabe incident? I doubt anyone would have heard of that incident. So it's just an example of how certain incidents in the Northeast have gotten significant prominence, and certain incidents in the Northwest may not have gotten as much. In fact, in the past 8 weeks, I've been involved in several trainings, different state engagements in Nigeria. Within that short period, we've had several kidnappings. There was a kidnapping over 160 students. There was another kidnapping involving about 60. They're almost on a daily basis, you find these sort of incidents that happen in the Northwest. And with that, of course, we're seeing a growing population of IDPs and individuals that would need humanitarian support. I will go straight into sharing a bit about our story in Nîmes. We have sometimes I struggle to describe it in an interesting way. Like the best way to tell it is in form of a story. Just over a decade ago, I mean, most of the founding members of NIM were on the other side. So by the other side, I mean we were working for a government agency called the National Security Advisors Office. That office was responsible for responding to issues of terrorism across the nation. There was a unit within that office called the Center for Countering Violent Extremism, as well as the Center for Counterterrorism. These were all spaces that the founding members were involved in. Between 2012 to 2015, what we found was that, and I think this is a lessons learned that we probably, I hope with the hope of, with the help of ODI, we can carry on into other spaces, is a heavy focus on regional interventions, regional-based interventions. So what we found was that when the insurgency started, rather than us focusing on how do we support the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, how do we look at the structures that we have existing in government and mainstream humanitarian support. One of the things that was done, as with a lot of things, I'm sure you also mentioned some of this in England and maybe your countries as well, is to set up a very specific committee to deal with that issue. So we had a committee called the Presidential Committee for the Northeast Initiative. When that evolved, it was called the Special Presidential Initiative for the Northeast Initiative, something like that, or response. And that also evolved because at some point they said, okay, maybe we can call a commission and that would be better. So now we have a Northeast Development Commission. But again, it speaks to a lot of the evolution of the crisis in Nigeria. Again, just to reiterate, that's the background in which NIM evolved in. So in 2016, when there was a change of government, we felt it was very important for us to pivot some of our lessons learned within the agency into a non-profit space that will have a focus on, I know everyone is tired of hearing non-kinetic efforts, but that will have a focus on delivering non-kinetic efforts from a humanitarian lens. So that's the story of me. Since then, again, one of the stereotypes we hear quite often, and anytime we go into meetings, particularly with international actors, and we talk to them about the work of me, usually the first response we get is, "Do you mind partnering with IOM to engage on this engagement? Do you mind partnering with UNDP?" We've already given our money to UN OCHA. We've already given our money to UNICEF. Can you go and engage with them? Again, I mean, these are agencies that are doing really incredible work, and we deeply appreciate that. But you can imagine an entity that came with so much capacity and insights, fact-based insights, working in government, trying to establish a robust structure I think we call them evidence-based programming. And at every point in every meeting, you're told to go and engage with the big actors. So this is a story of how we evolved into looking beyond some of the conventional spaces organizations look at. For instance, again, we started as a direct result of the conflict in the Northeast. But when we started, we realized that I mean, the Northeast was just the tip of the iceberg. We saw some of the challenges happening in the Northwest. We saw some of the challenges happening in the North Central of Nigeria. And we saw some of the challenges happening across the border in Chad, Cameroon, Niger, even surprisingly, parts of Syria and Lebanon. So we found ourselves being a very tiny organization that started in a very tiny office that was donated by a very generous person in Nigeria, to expanding into several states, doing engagements in several countries because we decided to look beyond the traditional definition of what humanitarian needs would be, especially from the lens of international actors. Some of the things that we've been able to do, for instance, is to next slide, please. Look at key priority areas that we felt needed attention. For instance, one of the things that we realized very quickly is that the role of communication and advocacy, or strategic communication in this sense, would be pivotal in the way we engage with different actors, whether it's communities or donor actors. So one of the things we did was to set up a robust structure through partnerships, right? So what we did differently from other organizations that operate, but in Africa, you see, you tend to want to wait for donors to come in, and there are quite a few donors willing to support. But what we did was we looked, okay, what sort of presence do we have of institutions that could give us that access? So we partner with an agency called the Federal Radio Corporation of Nigeria, and we started deploying programs that could reach 10 million individuals every Monday. And this gave us an outlet to talk about key issues of policy, key issues of non-kinetic efforts to counter violent extremism. And that's how we began to understand that sometimes you don't need funding to actually deploy engagement, and that's how we evolved. We also created very strategic partnerships with the likes of ODI. That's why one of our strengths is the research on policy. Peace building is also a heavy element of our work. As you know, part of the crisis in the Northwest is because of the conflict dynamics between farmers and herders. As you know, some of the most parts of the Sahel have started drying up. Some parts of the Sahel have dried up entirely. So you find a lot of herders or groups that were traditionally herders coming closer into the southern part of Nigeria. And undoubtedly, over time, with multiple factors that we can talk about some other day, that meant that some of the herding groups became highly militant. As a result of that, we're now seeing significant clashes between farmers and herders. In fact, a week before I came here, we had to go to the north, one of the northwest states, to respond to one of these issues of land encroachment, issues of water rights, issues of land rights, issues of the erosion of the traditional grazing routes that have existed across the Sahel and West Africa. Some of these routes have existed for close to 400 years. So we're now seeing the erosion of that as a result of climate change. Again, we saw gender and social inclusion as a part that we wanted to engage in. This is something that we mainstream across the different programs that we do. For education, we attempted something quite creative in the sense that we were able to really look at what are the ways that we can really address issues of critical thinking and logical reasoning. So we introduced a new curriculum, a creative curriculum that is trauma-informed, to set up a school where we're piloting all these initiatives. It's called the Lafiya Sarari Initiative. In the school, we have 50% of the girls in the school are former children of former Boko Haram members. 50% of the students in the school are children of former CJTF members. These are groups that were fighting on the other side. So those are some of the things that we were able to roll out on that front. And as you know, one of the key areas for us is the addressing the level of trauma we've seen in the entire region. Because of that, we've rolled out something creative called the Counselor on Wheels Initiative. We can go to the next slide. The Counselor on Wheels Initiative is sort of addressing the need for a more local approach to engaging on issues of trauma. So we don't drive into the communities with the big international funded bulletproof trucks. We have what we call tuk-tuks. I'm sure it's very popular in India and parts of Africa. It's very appealing to the communities to see people they know, to see types of materials or even vehicles they can attribute to their community. We have a training program where psychologists are trained for about 9 months. When they're trained, after that training, they deploy to the communities. And this is something that we've now decided to deploy to the Northwest. In fact, we have a version of that that's being funded by NEEM itself, not waiting for funding to come, but using what we've generated to deploy that program. Next slide. Yes, thank you. So part of the work that we're trying to do, as I mentioned, is to expand this to this program to the Northwest. But since then, we've had the opportunity to have this approach independently assessed by King's College in UK. It has also been launched with the support of the United Nations, and we hope that it will be used in multiple countries very soon. Next slide. Some of the things we've also been gaps that we've noticed, and this is speaking particularly in the context of the Northwest, is the absence of capacity to engage on issues of reintegration of farmers. So, for instance, what you found is in the Northeast, there's a lot of capacity because people have engaged in these issues. But in the Northwest, they haven't done much of that. So that's a focus we're looking at. We're also expanding to engage on issues of ethnic driven crisis, religious driven crisis, land dispute, like I mentioned with the farmers and herder crisis, as well as also trying to bridge the gap between security and community actors through structures that we've now set up across 18 communities in that region. In terms of lessons learned, and please, everyone should be proud of me. I'm often accused of not being able to summarize in a very nice way. So thank you for your patience. In terms of lessons learned, I think for us in Nigeria, what we've seen is the conflict constantly changes, right? It started with the civil war in the 70s. We've seen the Niger Delta militancy. We've seen the insurgency in the Northeast. We've now seen banditry and kidnappings in the Northwest. And we're now seeing a rise of secessionist movements, groups that are literally saying that it's time for us to set up our own country and leave. Right. So within all these issues that we're seeing in an evolving environment, what we found as a lessons learned is there's a need for a rapid adaptation process by development partners that takes into account the very frequent changing dynamics in a lot of countries, not just Nigeria. Another area that we've also found is the lack of flexibility in donor funding. One of the things we found is that your donor would say, "Oh, we have this amount of funding for you to do this work." And we go to the donor and we say, "This is the area that we think is most needed." And the donor will say, "We like your assessment, but the funding is for this particular location. So let's stick to that." So I think that flexibility, it's something that needs to be addressed. There's also a lack of prioritization of preemptive measures. So usually the humanitarian needs are usually things that are looked at when the conflict has gone very far. But oftentimes you can predict the type of humanitarian needs a particular region would need. That's something we recommend heavily. Another area that we recommend is also to look at how to make government policy more coherent. I think that will give a better avenue for international actors to deploy their support. Also, the interconnected nature of the conflicts that we're seeing across the country. One of the things that we realize is that if the Northeast is having a humanitarian crisis, that can make parts of the Northwest more vulnerable because then resources are rerouted to that particular location. And then finally, I'll end with this. Like when I was coming for this presentation, I spoke to a former colleague that still works with government, and I asked him what's the problem with that we're having in Nigeria, and how can we address it? How can I explain people the context that we're having? And then he said, "Well, Ahmed, the problem we're having is that we have ungoverned minds governing ungoverned spaces." And he said the way to address that is education. And rightly so, one of the things you see is Nigeria has one of the largest population of out-of-school children in the world. Part of the things he recommended, and also we found to be very positive in him, is once you're able to foster critical thinking, logical reasoning amongst a populace, it makes it a bit easier for us to engage on these complex issues and have them contribute also effectively to the type of humanitarian needs that would be most appropriate for them. So thank you very much, everyone. Again, thank you for the patience with my summarized version of the presentation.
Great. Thank you so much, Ahmed. We have a couple of minutes left. I mean, I have a question for you, but I mean, if there's anything in the room or online, please do chip in. I mean, my question is essentially just in the couple of minutes that we have, for international actors and donors who may or may not be present in spaces like this, who are, hear the message that the Northwest is a is an urgent humanitarian situation, but are wary to engage in something that is so appears so complex and ambiguous and protracted already. What sort of advice would you give those people without the kind of the Nigeria knowledge coming into a context like the Northwest and seeking to assist organizations like NEEM? What would be the best sort of thing they could do, or the first thing?
I think one of the reflections, and I think we had this discussion yesterday over coffee, is and I get this with a lot of African non-profit organizations as well, is the constant perception that we need capacity building, you know? So I think one recommendation I would give them is never make the assumption that what we need is capacity building to be able to engage in humanitarian or development support. A lot of times there's a lot of capacity within so many nonprofit organizations. I think engage directly with local nonprofits. It is good to be informed by the international actors. Oftentimes they have the most resources to conduct the type of assessments that needed to have a very deep understanding. But I think engaging directly also gives room to have to address the issue of localization we're talking about very soon. As you know, there's a shift in funding, and a lot of it is now going to the Middle East. We wouldn't have the 46 humanitarian actors in the Northeast. What happens then? You know, and that is why we always recommend a lot of international actors to really focus on deploying that sort of support, working closely with nonprofit organizations such as NEEM and many other actors across the region that could support. So those are just, I guess that's a very brief internet, yes.
Thank you very much, Ahmed. If there's no questions from the room, we conclude there on time. But just to say, just to go back to my original just point, which is that this is the work that I spoke to is to be published in the next couple of weeks. You can stay updated by going to odi.org, and at the bottom of that page, there's a subscribe to our newsletter. You can also contact me directly, so my email's there. And Ahmed and I are here for today and tomorrow. So please do approach us if you have any further questions or are interested. So thank you all for attending, and yeah, hope you have a good Thursday. Thanks.